In 1940s Adelaide, Ruby is about to start her married life. She's met a young soldier, Arthur, and in the years ahead, she will build a life with this man, renovating a home, raising children, and only occasionally wondering if this is all there is. Melting Moments by the Australian writer and pianist Anna Goldsworthy is a touching and bittersweet story about feminism, family, and desserts. Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
Anna, we should mention this is a strange time to be launching a book during this coronavirus outbreak. What's this like for you?
Oh, well, it's very surreal and, it's strange for everybody, isn't it? It's probably not the optimal time at which one would seek to release one's baby into the wild. And yet, it's the least of my concerns, really, is the traction of the book in the current crisis. And, in some ways, as you were saying, as you so beautifully put it, maybe this is an opportunity for us all, as we go into a form of enforced retreat, it's an opportunity for us all to be a little bit more contemplative and pick up more books. And also, I think the pleasures of escapism suddenly become really, really important.
Well, let's talk about your book, Melting Moments. I believe this started with stories of your late grandmother, Anna. What can you tell me about her?
Oh, she was a wonderful storyteller. When I look back at it, I just realised I'd sort of absorbed so many anecdotes over the years. And towards the end of her life, I used to sit down with her and with my grandfather and just record them in conversation, not because I specifically wanted to, construct a book out of it, but just because I was fascinated by their history and, their history of meeting in wartime Adelaide. And then later in life, after my grandfather passed away, my grandmother, who was then in her late 70s, took up with a fellow who she'd previously danced with at the Palais. And she enjoyed this sort of honeymoon with him, a kind of second honeymoon throughout her 80s. Bob, his name was Bob, and they'd travel around. And I was living in Melbourne at that time, and they drove over to Melbourne to take me and my partner out to dinner one night. And she just had this sort of footloose and fancy-free final 7 years. And there was something very, very beautiful about that and very hopeful about that. And I think perhaps it was that that was the kernel of this book or sort of prompted my interest in this story.
It's a gorgeous story. What did the family make of your grandma taking up with a new guy in her late 70s?
Oh, we were all delighted. I remember her neighbour was a little bit judgy about it because eventually when she was diagnosed with Parkinson's, he moved in to be her live-in carer and it caused a little bit of a stir in the retirement village. But we were all delighted. I mean, there was no sense that he supplanted my grandfather. She would still speak highly of my grandfather, but it was just gorgeous to see her out and about enjoying life after so many years of being such a dutiful wife and fully absolving herself of her duty. And I remember, he'd take my mother and my aunt and my uncle out for drives in the hills, and my uncle would call out from the back seat, "Hands on the wheel, Bob," because he might have one hand resting on my grandmother's leg. And there was just something truly gorgeous about it, and we couldn't have been more delighted.
Well, look, I'm recognising a lot of the beats of this story of your grandmother in the book that I've read, Melting Moments. And I guess this really comes back to this classic question about the line, Anna, between fiction and memoir. You have been a memoirist. Is this an easy line to delineate for you?
I think it's, I don't know if there is actually a line. I always think of it as being more of a spectrum. And I know in my two memoirs, I used, I suppose, what you would call fictional techniques or, various kind of conventions of narrative, and that would include the reconstruction of dialogue. And so there's imaginative work that goes into creating a memoir. And then I think the sort of flip side of that is that most fiction, I think, has to be based on some form of a writer's experience, whether it's things that have happened to them or stories they've heard. So to my mind, it's always a little bit of a continuum. And a lot of the books that I most admire, I think, occupy somewhere in the middle. And, I'm thinking of anything from In Search of Lost Time, Proust, which I love, through to this recent really fascinating trilogy by Rachel Cusk. And in a way, I think perhaps when I'm reading a book, I'm less interested in was that the fact than, whether it feels like truth on the page, whether it actually feels like the world that I recognise is right there on the page. And sometimes I get a greater sense of truth, human truth, in a work of fiction than I do in a memoir. And I think that's probably what interests me most of all.
But this is your first official foray into fiction. As you mentioned, you've got two memoirs under your belt, including Piano Lessons. But what has it been like for you to stretch this fiction muscle, Anna, officially?
It's interesting that you should put it like that, because I had a lovely session at Adelaide Writers Week just 10 days ago with the wonderful Anna Crean, and she used exactly that term, you know, getting her fiction muscle into a degree of fitness. Oh, I love it, actually. I find fiction, I've discovered fiction to be very freeing, but beyond that, a really interesting way to explore complexity. You know, it's quite different from writing an opinion piece where you actually have to come out on one side or another in a way. And I think fiction, for me at least, allows a way to express two truths at the same time. I mean, this character of Ruby, for instance, it was a very fulfilled and fulfilling life. And yet at the same time, you know, there are moments in which she wonders if there's more. And so I think I find it actually fiction, I have discovered in the writing of this, fiction not only to be, you know, creative and sort of fun and freeing, but beyond that, just a really useful and interesting way to try to figure stuff out.
I do wonder how you have time to do that though, Anna. You are working at the top of your game in this field, but you're also a working concert pianist. How do you pursue two creative careers at this very high level at the same time?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's probably a little bit foolhardy to try to do both, but I do find when I'm when I'm traveling as a musician, there is downtime. There are, you know, countless hours sitting on planes, sitting in airports, or there were when I was still traveling. And in a way, even the structure of this book, I mean, I've constructed this book not as a kind of traditional narrative, but more as a series of moments in time. And I think that form occurred to me for a couple of reasons. One is that I was looking for a way to convey the sort of reality of what it's like to live, you know, and it doesn't always unfold as much as we like to impose these narratives and these plots on our life. It doesn't always unfold with a really clear sense of unidirectionality or plot. But beyond that, I found that almost creating these tableau or these moments or these sort of discrete little short stories in a way suited my life quite well. And I was able to get my head around a moment sitting on an aeroplane better able than I would be, you know, sitting down and writing a plot that I kind of had to hold in my head as sort of one discrete organism. So I just fit the writing often into the spare bits of my life. And then, you know, for weeks at a time, I might not have much going on in terms of performances. And what I found a godsend actually in the writing of this book was writer's retreats. So I spent a week at beautiful Varuna in the Blue Mountains. And I also spent a few weeks staying at this extraordinary place in South Australia called Eucaria, which is essentially a concert hall, but it's got a little artist retreat next to it. And that was invaluable for me. Not so much to get away from music, but more to get away from my two beloved sons who, you know, a wonderful company but never stop talking. And sometimes as a writer, you do need to be able to hear the voice in your head, and children are not always conducive to that.
This book actually does feature music as well, Anna, music by Schubert. The protagonist, Ruby's mother and brother, both play his musical moments. Why this particular music?
Well, I just love Schubert to start with. I just find this such beautiful, intimate, vulnerable, ambivalent, poetic, tragic, uplifting, human, fundamentally human music. And these particular small pieces, these Moments Musicaux, in a way, there's an analogy between them and the structure I was seeking in this book, which is that they're all about, you know, discrete moments. It's not like a sort of Beethoven sonata or symphony where you have this epic sort of hero's trajectory often. That's not what they're about. It's about, this is a glimpse of lived experience. And it's not always black and white. I mean, Schubert, more than any composer, has this extraordinary way of sort of dovetailing between the major and the minor, between hope and tragedy. And that kind of poignancy or that sort of nuanced combination of just seems to me to be what life is often like. It's really completely major, it's really completely minor, and I'm kind of interested in sort of teasing out those in-between bits, and in that sense Schubert was a sort of powerful inspiration.
Well, let's talk about some of the moments in this book called Melting Moments. We meet Ruby Jenkins. She's a young woman in the 1940s. And it seems in many ways it's quite an exciting time to be this young woman in Adelaide. She's learning to type. She's out dancing at the Palais. How much fun was it for you to pore through Adelaide's history at this time?
Oh, I loved that. I loved sort of digging out photos of, you know, people at dance halls looking incredibly glamorous with their gloves. And yeah, I loved sort of seeking the texture of that time and inhabiting that world, which, you know, speaking of the crisis that we're undergoing at the moment, there's a lot of similarities between this and the demands that were made of people during the Second World War.
In what way?
I think the notion of really being there for each other, of pulling together as a community to deal with a common problem. I mean, obviously, there's a sort of really substantial difference, which was that in the 40s and late 30s, you're allowed to go out and about and see each other. But there was a sense of, I think, having to dig deep, having to develop a sense of what you could do without, having to realign your notion of what actually is important. And I think we're going to be confronting that at the moment. And maybe what's important is not actually, you know, rampant consumption, but it's things like looking after those who are dear to us. It's returning to some of the pleasures of the house, of the domestic, of, you know, things like baking, for instance. And just a huge resourcefulness was demanded of the population. And we haven't actually had those demands placed on us yet as a people, and we are now. And I think one of the beautiful things that we saw in the Second World War was how many people actually managed to meet those challenges and flourish and look out for each other.
So Ruby marries a young World War II soldier, Arthur. He goes off to war before the marriage is even consummated. How much does Ruby know about this man she has married?
Not a lot, I think. I mean, they'd been stepping out together, but the whole sort of process of their marriage was hastened by his enlistment. But then, I mean, I guess in a way, one of the ongoing questions of the book is how much do you ever know about somebody else, even over the course of a lifetime? And when he returns from war, like many soldiers of that time, he chooses not to speak about his experiences. And so in a way, there's this huge mystery that remains at the heart of their marriage for the rest of their life together. And, you know, in the book, there's one moment at which he actually seeks finally to speak to her about why he received a discharge, a kind of medical discharge, apparently because of anxiety, but there's also some sort of stigma associated to that. So it's never sort of fully articulated or spoken about. And on the one time that he actually seeks to speak to her about it, it's very clear that she doesn't want to hear it. She'd much, much rather preserve the mystery.
Ruby strikes me very much as a woman of this particular generation. You know, she marries the first man she's ever kissed. She's this dutiful wife. She makes endless cups of tea for her husband. She's always busy with chores around the house. Does Ruby ever wish for anything more from her life?
I think she does. I think she glimpses moments of transcendence and they take different forms. I think she's a remarkably strong person. And, you know, as so many women of that generation were, you know, she holds it all together. But just occasionally, you know, she wonders whether that more is available in life. And that's enacted in various ways. You know, it's enacted in a little bit of sexual frisson, which isn't ever sort of followed up upon about a fellow that she dances with at the Palais. She perhaps gets a glimpse of something that she rather likes when she does a modelling course and she's suddenly on stage and the centre of all these people's attention, a glimpse of another version of life which might be more glamorous or more Hollywood or something. And then later on, as her daughter grows up and starts just sort of pushing aside so many of these restrictions that had governed Ruby's own life and becoming, you know, quite a feminist in quite a radical way, I think that's another sort of possible glimpse of other ways of being.
Yeah, so her daughter Eva grows up, pursues medicine, gets a divorce. I mean, how confronting is this for Ruby, who probably couldn't imagine these sorts of things in her own life?
Yes, that's one of the things that I discovered, actually, I think, in the writing of this book is, you know, I mean, I was brought up by a mother who was, I think, in the context of her time, quite a radical feminist. And so I grew up with feminism as my birthright, as the very premise of the way I moved through the world. And yet how rapid the transition was from my grandmother's way of life to my way of life in two generations. One of the things I was seeking to do in this was try to get into her head and imagine what experience, what life would have been like for a woman of that generation who didn't have my opportunities. But one thought I'd never really had until I sat down to write this book was what this would have looked like for my grandmother to be on the other side of that particular wave of feminism, to have a daughter who grew up and refused to accept the status quo in so many ways. I didn't have to fight those fights myself because my mother did, and she was fierce. And how did my grandmother accept that? You know, it would have been a fundamental challenge to everything that she sort of grew up to believe. And how did she sort of adjust to it and roll with it and end up being incredibly supportive of my mother? And I think that's probably a dynamic that was played out in numerous relationships between mothers and their daughters in that generation.
Mm. One thing I do like in the book is that Arthur, Ruby's husband and Eva's dad, seems quite proud of his feminist forthright daughter.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I think he's a very, ultimately a very supportive character in the book, which is, I think, quite beautiful. The generosity of, you know, such fathers towards their daughters, I think, is a very beautiful thing even now. And, you know, two generations ago when that was all very, very new, I think it's a very, very beautiful thing.
Can we talk a bit about baking, Anna? Because it's very rarely in this book that Ruby doesn't have something in the oven. Your grandmother, was she a baker?
She was, yes, yeah. Much more so than I am. Well, actually, you know, melting moments, strangely.
Yeah.
I loved her melting moments. And, you know, in the course of writing this book, I thought I'd better make a few batches and remind myself of what the process was like. But they never quite matched the way hers would just dissolve in the mouth. Or, you know, the pleasure of turning up at her house and seeing a whole lot of those balls being rolled out, and then that really gratifying moment of pressing them down with a fork. And my mum makes a mean melting moment too. So I was very much interested in that whole thing of baking. But, I mean, I suppose it's a way of creating a feeling of home. But beyond that, there's something so beautifully transient about baked goods too. You know, if we're talking about transient moments of human experience, what else is a biscuit? What else is a melting moment biscuit? You put it in your mouth and there's a terrific sweetness and it dissolves and it's over. And I suppose so much of a woman's life of that generation was about those moments that were essentially quite transient.
But there's something too about the politics of baking, what to serve to your mother-in-law, your future mother-in-law, what to serve to that pesky neighbour at the retirement village, judging someone when they bring out a shop-bought cake. What did you learn about the hidden meanings and the politics of cakes and what you serve?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's interesting how baking becomes a sort of way of denoting status. Yeah, I mean, bought cake, you know, bought cake, I think, would have been a rather sort of shocking thing in certain circles, like the notion that you couldn't make it yourself. And naturally, you know, when this becomes your arena of expertise and competence, I think it's natural that a degree of judgmentalism will arise about the baking efforts of others. And I think, you know, we see that played out a little bit in this book as Ruby quietly makes judgments of other people's jam or things that she's served.
There's also this really touching moment when Ruby's daughter Eve has her first day of school and Ruby's missing her daughter. She makes this fruit cake to bring to school and Eve rejects it.
Yeah, I suppose in that sense the cake is emblematic of all this motherly love and all this way that she, what the nature of her contribution in a way. And it's a scene that's echoed later on in the book in which Eva moves out of home, and both of them are scenes of great loss and a type of grief. And we all know this is very real, like the first day once children start school. It's often for many mothers, and certainly for me, it was a day of pretty significant grief, or just a sense that this is the next chapter. And the intense intimacy that you have with your preschooler just, you know, it sort of dissipates. And in many ways, it's replaced by things that end up being even more stimulating and interesting and fascinating. But there is certainly a significant change. And And those multiple renunciations that I think are a really large part of motherhood, of being able to surrender, of being able to let go, were something I wanted to look at in this book.
So I know you went into the kitchen and you practiced making your melting moments, but I mean, gosh, this must have been fun, right? Getting to taste all these cakes and make sure you could remember how great a ginger cake was before writing it into the book.
Well, you know, the funniest thing, the kind of spookiest, most uncanny thing that happened to me was, you know, I mentioned that I'd been at this writer's retreat in the Blue Mountains for Verona Ryder's house, and the house, it was sort of much grander, but it reminded me quite a lot of my grandmother's house. So it was a sort of really good and powerful place to be working on this book, and it smelt the same as I remembered her house smelling. And one day I was writing and I needed a break, so I popped downstairs to grab a piece of chocolate cake, which was there, took it up to my study, and I was writing this chapter on ginger cake, and I took a forkful of it and bit into it and discovered it was ginger cake, which, you know, I hadn't tasted for ages. It was, and I'd been writing about it. I almost felt a little bit like that sort of bizarre notion of the secret. People believe you can manifest things. I don't buy into that. And yet it did feel like some sort of, it was sort of wonderful when those weird synchronicities occur when you're writing something, and to actually be able to taste the cake that I was writing about was not only uncanny, but I think it was very, very useful. And in many ways, that's the best type of research, to actually get in there and, you know, taste the era that you're writing about in your mouth.
Yeah, I like any sort of research that involves eating cake. And as I talk to you, I realise, of course, the title, Melting Moments, we're talking about these moments in time. It also alludes to the quick passing of time in the book.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, it does sort of whiz by in the way that a life whizzes by, and there are moments at the beginning and moments at the end that sort of reflect each other. Actually, there are moments throughout that sort of certain things recur, whether it's lying in the arms of a lover, or whether it's, you know, saying goodbye to your child. There's so much about life that's sort of self-replicating, or whether it's sitting on the Murray. And yet, yeah, transience, I think, is a really fundamental part of it. And the elusiveness, ultimately, of all of these moments, everything passes, as we know.
Oh, it's a beautiful book, Anna. It's called Melting Moments. It's published by Black Ink. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely to chat.
And here are some musical moments by Schubert.